I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Welcome to The Connection. What are you? That's a question that people who are biracial get asked all the time, either directly or indirectly. Are you black? Are you white? Are you Latino? If you are mixed race in the United States, you're part of the fastest growing segment of the population. Something like 10% of Americans identify as multiracial, although that number is probably a lot higher if everyone knew who was in their family tree. The presidential candidacy of Kamala Harris, who was of Black and South Asian heritage, has put a spotlight on the issue of identity and race, just like Barack Obama did in 2008 when he ran for president. On The Connection today, what do you call yourself if you are mixed race? Do you choose one race over the other? Do you embrace them both? Does your self-identity reflect how society, how strangers see and treat you? We'll be talking about the challenges and advantages of having multiple racial identities, especially in a country with our fraught racial history. And we are joined by three guests, two of whom join me here in our Philadelphia studios. Darylise Lyons is publisher of the Chestnut Hill and Mount Airy Locals, also co-host of the podcast On Being Biracial. Darylise Lyons, nice to have you on The Connection.
Thank you so much for having me, Marty. It's great to be here with you and your listeners.
Absolutely. And Malcolm Burnley with us as well, staff writer for the Philadelphia Citizen, and he is the other host of the On Being Biracial podcast. And Malcolm, nice to have you with us on The Connection.
Always great to be with you, Marty.
And joining us also is Sarah Gaither, and she's a professor of psychology, director of the Identity and Diversity Lab at Duke University. And Sarah Gaither, thank you for joining us on The Connection as well. We have a lot to talk about.
Yes, honored to be here.
Well, let me start with last night, and I don't want to spend the whole hour talking about Kamala Harris, but nonetheless, we're talking about something that's historic on several different levels. But I have to say, after she gave her speech and her family, her extended family, came up on stage, I was just struck by the sort of gumbo of racial identities there, from nieces and aunties and white people and black people and Asian people. I wonder, Darylise, if you just want to comment about this moment that we're in.
Yeah, sure, Marty. I think I think it's really exciting. I think it's an opportunity for different kinds of conversations to come to the surface. And I think that what you pointed out is, you know, visually things are different. They're changing. And I think there's no denying that. So, I thought last night was exciting on a number of different levels.
How about for you, Malcolm?
Yeah, I mean, definitely concur with all of that. And I don't mean to introduce any cynicism, but I think one of the things that was interesting, too, was in her speech, she definitely brought up her own parents' ethnicity, but didn't talk explicitly about race. So on the one hand, I think this is a very exciting moment, and it's very meaningful to a lot of people, including myself. But on the other hand, I think there's also still some challenges with how we discuss, you know, multiracial identity and the lack of discussion, too.
And Sarah, let me give you a chance to weigh in as well. And I think it's interesting to also look back at Barack Obama. That was 16 years ago. Yes. when he ran for president. Do you think the world, meaning the United States of America, have we changed when it comes to this issue of race and being biracial?
I don't think we've changed necessarily. I think race has been very complicated ever since we've constructed it and reconstructed it and deconstructed it. What I think was particularly powerful across the DNC was Kamala Harris's approach in making a visual political message as it relates to race and ethnicity, right? All the different types of folks and what they were wearing, even the physical attire from saris to more Western wear. To me, I think that's where we're sort of shifting and being a little more open to being bold on stage and being open and talking about what these identities may or may not mean for different Americans.
And Sarah, do you think visual representation is more powerful than what we say?
I think it's tricky because not everyone wants to acknowledge that race exists, right? Here I am as this biracial scholar who studies race for a living, and people tell me constantly, well, race isn't real. Why do you study it? So I think the visual representation of culture is a way to spark conversation for people who maybe don't think about race and ethnicity as much as others.
It's interesting. I'll go back to you, Darylise, which is, you know, I think I'll speak broadly about the United States. We tend to think of biracial as black and white, but what we're seeing is that is not true. I mean, it's just much more complicated, much more diverse than just black and white.
Absolutely. And in the On Being Biracial podcast, which you referenced, Malcolm and I interviewed, I think, about 45 people, of which Sarah Gaither was one. Right. So hi, Sarah. Great to be with you.
Hello again. And
that was one of the things that we really pointed to. You know, there's a unique and particular narrative that tends to cling to those of us with Black, white racial ancestry that is very different than those for whom maybe both of their racial identities are underrepresented. And then, you know, there's all sorts of racial dynamics and computations of humanity, and then based on where someone is geographically, or based on their gender experience, or based on the household where they grew up, or, you know, based on appearance and so many different factors, cultural influences, you know, that there's a lot of diversity within the multiracial community, and I would say maybe more than monoracial communities on the whole. And so it is complicated. And in terms of the visual point, you know, you can't always see what someone's been through based on the surface of their skin or how they identify or their backgrounds or who they are. So it is very, very complicated.
It is. And we'll dig into that. Some of those complications. Malcolm, I was thinking, and I sort of referenced this in my introduction, of, you know, people doing 23andMe and going on the PBS show Finding Your Roots, and lo and behold, you find out that what you think you are or your family is not what it turned out to be.
Absolutely. And I had not exactly that experience, but I certainly did a 23andMe and was actually almost surprised that there weren't any surprises. But I think what's interesting about that, particularly within the Black community, is that, you know, mixed race identity, although it's being defined more now, mixed race heritage is nothing new. And so it's this interesting conversation, I think, now about creating a new label or new labels and new ways to talk about it. Because in the past, you know, traditionally with the one drop rule and also just a lot of social, constructions and obstacles, you know, the default was to just identify just as Black, even if you were mixed, right? And so there is this interesting, I guess, yeah, just development currently about acknowledging it and all the mixture and you know, I guess all the ambiguity, as opposed to just choosing to identify only with your minority race.
And I do want to get back and actually ask the three of you some personal questions, but I do, Sarah, want you to weigh in. And I have to confess myself about using the right language. You know, is it multiracial? Is it mixed race? Is it mixed? And, you know, language can trip you up. It can be significant. It can mean nothing. Has the language, I guess, caught up with sort of where we are in talking about being biracial or being of mixed racial heritages?
Yeah, we're seeing more and more young people in particular, right? So when I grew up, to date myself, right, I'm biracial, Black, white, but look very white on the outside. I was born in 84. We didn't have a lot of icons in public spaces or media, right? And now I'm seeing with all the kids we recruit to our lab that a lot of them do use words like biracial, multiracial mix. Some kids call themselves little swirls. So I think we're seeing this broader acceptance of different types of terms. Mm-hmm. But what I find is the most interesting and complicated at the same time is there's not really a trend on which label or term leads to the best or worst outcomes, right? It's all very individual differences, right, on what it is you choose to represent yourself. And so that notion of identity autonomy, I think, is really, really important for us to consider when thinking about the larger multiracial demographic.
Indeed. And Sarah, so how do you identify yourself?
I identify as biracial, Black, white. My dad's Black. My mom's white. I think, you know, for people like me who outwardly don't look like one of their racial heritages, it's a different type of experience. And if you only look like one side, you're constantly defending the other side and kind of trapped between worlds. And so that notion of belonging is really what we've been showing and a lot of other multiracial scholars over time to be the biggest issue that the multiracial community faces.
And to you, Darylise, and I saw a TED Talk that you gave about embracing both of your identities.
Yeah, right. And I think to build off of what Sarah was saying, for me, the point that I tried to make in the TED Talk was that I do embrace both of my racial identities. I, too, am Black, white, biracial. Dad is Black. Mom is white. And I think really identity autonomy is the takeaway that I would hope those watching took from that, which is that, you know, I'm not here to tell anyone how they should identify or who they should be or how they should see themselves. And I would say that no one has a right to tell anyone who they are based on their perceptions, that really individuals should be able to claim, you know, who they are and how they see themselves, and that that can change over a person's lifetime or based on particular situations. I know you asked Sarah what she is. I am biracial as well. That hasn't been an unwavering designation for me throughout my lifetime. But I do notice that in certain spaces, I lead with being Black and white, and in certain spaces, I lead with being white and Black. And I don't even know that I'm code switching in that way until after the fact. So it is really complicated.
It is. But I think the ability to code switch is a unique skill that, you know, mono-colored people like me, you know, white people like me, you know, we don't have those skills.
Right. Or that necessity, perhaps.
Or the necessity. Exactly. Yeah. How about for you, Matt?
Yeah, I now identify as Black and mixed. So to your point, all three of us, you know, identify differently, even though we both have, you know, mixtures of Black and white parents. You know, growing up, I almost only identified as Black, and then have come to identify as Black and mixed because I felt like mixed implies a certain experience I've had about, you know, people questioning my identity and you know, it not always being clear. And I just want to inject into this, you know, there are plenty of people who still push back on these labels. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason why that, and there's some that I can understand with, you know, if I can identify as Black and mixed, you know, there's a certain privilege people assume that comes with that. And I do think there are privileges with the experience, but it's really trying to accurately depict all of the entirety of my life, right? And including those privileges, right? I don't want to only identify as Black and ignore the fact of being lighter skinned, being othered in different ways. I want to acknowledge that. And so that's really what I guess what coming to identify as mixed, but it's a complicated.
Yeah, no, it's a word we've been used a lot so far in this show. But Sarah, what I hear from all three of you, and in preparation for the show from others, is it's choice. Is that you get to choose? I mean, maybe society chooses something else for you, but in terms of your own individual identity, you get to choose what you call yourself. We have about a minute before our first break.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what gets back to identity autonomy. What's so important, though, and it's not just you choosing, right? There's a lot of how we are treated, right, on a daily basis that forces us to feel like we can or can't claim parts of our identity more easily than others. And so I do want us to be careful in this conversation. And a lot of the comments against Kamala Harris's identity is that she's being a chameleon and choosing to play a race card, right, in order to benefit her at the polls. And that is this common perception for people within the multiracial community, is they're often just seen as choosing what works best for them, when really it's fluctuating across their entire lifespan.
Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Sarah Gaither, and she's a professor of psychology, director of the Identity and Diversity Lab at Duke University. And joining us here in our Philadelphia studios, Malcolm Burnley and Darylise Lyons. They are co-hosts of the podcast called On Being Biracial. Darylise Lyons is publisher of the Chestnut Hill and Mount Airy Locals, and Malcolm Burnley is staff writer for the Philadelphia Citizen. We have much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And we're talking about some of the benefits, some of the challenges of having multiple racial identities, especially in a country that tends to see things as either Black or white. And again, our guests are Sarah Gaither, Malcolm Burnley, and Darylise Lyons. Before we move on, though, I want to have a couple more questions about you all. And to you, Darylise, and this is really to all of you, but I think of adolescence as that time when young people are trying to figure out who the heck am I? And I wonder for you whether figuring out how you wanted to identify as a racial person, if I can put it that way, Were there struggles for you? Did you want one over the other? How did you land where you did?
You know, it's a really interesting question, and I love it. Thank you for asking that, Marty. I think that I was very fortunate in that early on in my life, my white mother joined Black Books Galore, and she joined an interracial parents and children's group. And so I really had a lot of exposure to, I would say, racial diversity and representation very, very early on. So since I was maybe 3 years old, I've been identifying as biracial. However, I'm just making this connection now on air, but I had a stepfather who was also of mixed race identity, who came into my life when I was about 11, and he identified as Black. And I think in particular because he was we had such a contentious relationship, I don't know that I did question my racial identity in adolescence. I had a lot of gender-based issues at that time, but I think it sort of compelled me to be more adamant about who I was and how I saw myself, because I didn't want to be like someone who didn't love me, right? So, we could talk about that for an hour, but sure. It's a really interesting question.
But it gets to just how, again, complicated, you know, where we come back to, but how complicated this stuff is. Nothing is in a kind of straight line.
It is not. And so many different dynamics influence, I think, a person's lived experience, which before the break we were talking about choice. But I think it is a lot about maybe describing one's reality. And so my reality, I think, has been very much I've navigated the world as a multiracial person, and my lived experience reflects that. But I could hold the exact same racial identity that I hold and have walked through the world as in a more monoracial way.
Sarah, let me get you in as a psychologist, and then Malcolm, I'll go to you. But I'm as a psychologist who has a probably deeper understanding of adolescence than I do. Are there particular struggles for people who identify as biracial or multiracial?
Yeah, I mean, adolescence is hard for anyone, right?
Sure,
no matter what
indeed.
Your racial or ethnic identity is, just to be fair.
Yeah.
But I think what's particularly challenging, especially during adolescence, when romantic partnerships are starting to come online, friend selections, birthday party invitations. There was some work a while ago in sociology that actually showed multiracial kids were least likely to be remembered when making birthday party invitation lists, which is one of those findings that just crushes my soul a little bit.
Wow.
And it's because if you're racially ambiguous in your appearance, you can't really think off the top of your head what someone is. Your brain actually just can't process it as easily. So you forget them. You forget that they even exist. So I think those are the types of belonging struggles, again, that's really common in adolescence in certain affinity groups, right? So Black student groups or whatever the case may be, thinking someone's not Black enough, or maybe your Spanish dialect isn't good enough or correct enough, right, to be in a Hispanic students group. And those are the types of identity-based exclusion experiences that we know start happening much more often around that age.
And Sarah, I read that as a kid, you actually wished that you were more Black looking. As you said, you present as white.
Yeah, it's one of those things. My younger brother, he got what we always joke about as the Black looking jeans, and I didn't. And he got to go to Black barbershops growing up and got that socialization, right, that I think I really yearned for. But, you know, my life has had a lot of privilege because of my skin color, and I'm not trying to deny any of that. But because I was raised by the Black side of my family more than the white side of my family, I think I always just felt like I didn't quite fit in because of my skin color.
How about for you, Malcolm? What was adolescence like for you?
Yeah, it was tough. You know, some of what Sarah was just describing, particularly with her own experience, I was just kind of chuckling myself because I remember growing up getting all sorts of certainly insensitive jokes, ethnic, racial jokes, but often they weren't quote unquote Black jokes, you know? And always being put in this weird position where I felt othered, and also I was almost like sticking up for other people's cultures, you know, in a way, and having a few moments where when someone it's going to sound strange, but when someone made a Black joke, getting viscerally upset, but then also having this strange validation because I was like, at least I'm getting othered in the right way, you know.
But that sounds so much like adolescence.
Absolutely.
Fitting in, belonging.
And so I think there was a lot, you know, as I mentioned, I identified as Black, you know, pretty much until my early 20s, where, you know, I started using the term mixed or biracial. And so I remember, you know, taking my school picture and wearing a FUBU jersey, a For Us, By Us, which is this Black company. And yet I had, you know, very straight hair at the time. And so there was always this difficulty with other people, I guess, delegitimizing in their mind what I identified as. And that has psychological effects. You know, I think I struggled with self-confidence and just kind of claiming space because I felt like when I tried to do that often, what people threw back at me was that it wasn't authentic or wasn't legitimate in their mind. And a lot of that was just kids, but still, when you're a kid yourself, it can be hard.
Well, and that doesn't stop, Darlies. I mean, I'm assuming through life, you know, people make assumptions about you that contradict how you feel about yourself, you are.
Absolutely. And I think I've had it go both ways where people have made assumptions that other me and sort of delegitimized belonging to borrow what Malcolm said, but I've also had assumptions made that I would sort of have a certain experience or know certain things that I don't really know, but in a way that was meant to draw me in. So I've definitely been in spaces where I've had people say, well, like, you know how those people are, but like, you know, we are different. And I'm like, but I'm sort of, but I'm also that too. And so, yeah, I think that, for me, I've had a lot of like inclusion experiences that also mean leaving parts of myself or checking parts of myself at the door, which is a weird sort of dissonance.
Well, there's that code switching that you were referencing earlier. Sarah, if I can go back to you, looking at child development, is there a certain developmental stage when children begin to see themselves as part of a certain racial group?
Yeah, it's a challenging question. What most psychology research would argue is that by the age of three or so is when gender identity comes online pretty firmly for kids. But race and ethnicity, it's much later. It's around ages five or six. But we think that that's actually even later for white children compared to racial and ethnic minority children. And that's just because you're usually having some sort of what they call an encounter experience, right? Someone had said something racist to you. Someone said, why is your skin color or your hair different than mine? So younger minority kids are having those experiences and they go home to their parents and have to ask their parents, why did this kid ask me about this, right? So we do find slightly different ages of race kind of coming online depending on a kid's background too.
And just going back quickly, and are you asked, Darlies, what are you? Are people that overt?
Oh, yeah. I've been asked what I am many, many times. I've also been told what I am. It's Malcolm and I, when we were in the middle of doing the On Being Biracial podcast, we were just before a recording session, I came online and I told him a story about how I was at the store, like, you know, buying lunch, and people guessed what I was like. They were taking out bets
strangers?
On what I was. Just strangers, yeah, came up to me and said, we made a bet on what race you are. So, like, what are
what
like,
are you?
Yeah, what are you? So yeah, I mean, I think, and interestingly enough, we interviewed someone who shared on the podcast that she was writing her doctoral thesis about race and ethnicity development and formation, and it wasn't until she was in grad school that she realized that other people weren't asked what are you on a regular basis. But that's been just part of the fabric of my life, so it's been so normalized, I would say, that I didn't really realize that there was anything different about that until later in life.
Yeah. And Malcolm, having read some of your articles, you're asked that all the time.
Yeah,
right?
Certainly. Yeah, that I've had that same experience a ton of times. Although I do feel like a little bit less so in recent years, and it's hard to gauge with the pandemic and, you know, just I'm more of a social hermit now, but I do feel like maybe there's some growing awareness just, you know, in terms of more people identifying as mixed. There's just more conversations about it. My hope is that certainly I still get that question, but maybe there's more awareness about how to approach those conversations. So it's not making someone feel uncomfortable.
And how about for you, Sarah?
I mean, I think because I look so phenotypically white, I haven't been asked the what are you question. I think I've had the opposite experience where I've had to prove my blackness instead. So I carry a family photo around with myself. You know, the party game questions I've been asked across my life is name all the rappers you can think of to prove my blackness, as if that's a criteria for being black in the U.S. So I think I've had different experiences, right, just based on how I look.
Let me just quickly reintroduce the three of you. Then I do want to play a clip from the NABJ conference where Donald Trump asked a question about Kamala Harris's race. And again, talking with Sarah Gaither. She's a professor of psychology, director of the Identity and Diversity Lab at Duke University. Malcolm Burnley and Darlies Lyons here with us in our Philadelphia studio, co-host of the On Being Biracial podcast, and Darylise Lyons, publisher of the Chestnut Hill and Mount Airy Locals, and Malcolm Burnley, staff writer for the Philadelphia Citizen. Well, this was last month, and Donald Trump was invited to speak at the NABJ, National Association of Black Journalists Conference, and he was asked about DEI and Kamala Harris, and this is just a portion of what he had to say.
She was always of Indian heritage, and she was only promoting Indian heritage. I didn't know she was black until a number of years ago when she happened to turn black, and now she wants to be known as black.
Sarah, let me start with you. First of all, completely untrue, but we'll sort of leave that at aside, and there are all sorts of political reasons what Donald Trump was trying to do. But what do you hear in that statement, Sarah?
What I hear, and kind of in line with a lot of the other statements former President Trump has said, is he just thinks it's impossible for someone to be more than one thing. He has this very, I think Michelle Obama listed this correctly, narrow way of thinking about race and other social categories in the U.S. And to me, that quote exactly summarizes that view, that you can only be one thing, you can't claim more than one thing, and that it's implying that she's being disingenuous, which based on any multiracial person's experience is just completely not true.
Darylise?
Yeah, I think that Donald Trump's comments said more about Donald Trump than they do about Kamala Harris. I think that she has always been very clear that her mother is Indian, her father is Jamaican, and she's lived an experience that honors both of her parents' identities. I also think that if you extend the clip on either side, Donald Trump doesn't pronounce her name correctly. I think there's a fundamental misunderstanding of who she is, or an intentional, overt, undermining of who she is and the way that she's navigated her multifaceted existence.
The way he mispronounces her name.
Yeah, yes. Mispronounces her name, misidentifies her racially. I mean, and frankly, I don't think that anyone is qualified to talk about her racial experience that is not her.
Well, let me quote something. She wrote a book called The Truths We Hold, and this was about her mother, who was came to America from India, and this is what she said about her mom. She knew her adopted homeland would see Maya and me as black girls, and she was determined to make sure we could grow up confident, proud black women. Mm-hmm. I mean, that she knew how the world was going to see her daughters, and in order to protect them and also help them grow and be full-bodied human beings, she was going to make sure that they embrace their black identity. Malcolm?
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting. I'm trying to read more of her book now, and I would hope that's something she would bring to the campaign trail at some point. I completely understand politically, race can often be a third rail, and as we were even talking about earlier, sometimes, showing rather than telling is more effective. But at the same time, I think that's really powerful, and one of the things that I kind of heard in Trump's very convoluted, and clearly he was trying to bait her into mm-hmm. talking about something. And so I totally respect why she would not want to directly, engage with that. But the reason why I think it would be in part powerful to talk about that or bring some of that writing to the voters is that one of my experience, and I think what we've all been talking about, is people see a certain ambiguity with multiracial identity, and it's often an opportunity to project certain agendas or ideas onto it. And so even though politically, and she may even be able to win the election by not talking about race, I think there's an opportunity to be able to define it herself rather than risk having other people kind of define or fill in those gaps for her.
Sarah, let me go back to you and just picking up on what Kamala and Maya Harris's mom did. I mean, in terms of raising biracial children, does that make sense to you?
I think it makes perfect sense. I mean, any parent wants to prepare their child as best as they can for the experiences they might face. And one thing that's actually really understudied is these socialization messages, right? What our parents are telling kids of multiracial, multiethnic descent, that's not studied nearly as much as within monoracial or monocultural families. And so knowing that if Kamala looked more physically Black, she's probably going to be facing more of those types of questions, which I think is a big reason why she ended up enrolling at an HBCU, joining a historically Black sorority, right? It was ingrained in her, and I think it was the perfectly right move, at least for the case in their family.
But I also think it's an interesting sort of moment in time where people are sort of reflecting and trying to figure out, you know, who someone is. And I think we even, at least I'll say for myself, if I'm walking my dog and I see another dog, I will often say to the person, is that a boy or a girl? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I don't, why do I care? but that we do sort of orient ourselves to other people based on maybe assumptions or stereotypes about who we think they are.
Yeah, well, I think that one of the things, and I'm really glad that Malcolm spoke to the opportunity potentially to address the issue of race more directly, but one of the things that I've been looking at is that Kamala Harris, I think, is an example within the Black community of what is possible, an example to young women and girls of what is possible, and an example in the Southeast Asian community of what is possible. And I think that sometimes, you know, I'm not saying she has to address race in any particular way, but I think one of the things that I loved about her talking about her multifaceted background and cultural background is that it does create a sense of representation for many different people about what is possible and the avenues that become open to them. And so, you know, I think that there's a way that sometimes people can want to put people in boxes so that it's more comfortable for them. But I also think that there's a whole lot of people who exist in a whole lot of boxes who, because Kamala Harris's identity spans those boxes, the more she talks about that and the more that she exemplifies and embodies that, the more exciting it becomes for the next generation of leaders.
Yeah, Malcolm, it looks like you want to add
something. Yeah, just following up on that. I mean, I think what's interesting, and we, you know, Barack Obama did certainly talk about race eventually as a candidate, but avoided it in many ways that similar to how Kamala has been. But I think there's a real opportunity to kind of push this conversation around mixed race, multiracial, biracial, however we want to talk about identity, and get people to expand their knowledge through Kamala, because as Marty already mentioned, a lot of people think about mixed race as just being Black and white, and that certainly is not the case, and increasingly not the case. But Barack Obama, including myself and Darylise and Sarah, we represent, I guess, that more traditional view or narrow view of what it is. And Kamala, coming from a South Asian background and a Black background, I think that that really can help people understand what race is, what it really isn't, in ways that Barack Obama's ancestry couldn't. And just the last point, you know, historically, I kind of mentioned this earlier, but with Black, white, mixed race people, right, it was always almost chosen for you. You know, dating back hundreds of years, right, it was a danger to identify as mixed or to acknowledge being mixed, because it was part of an illegal or non-consensual relationship. So being able to identify differently, it would be important to see in a candidate.
Another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about being biracial, and again, joining us, Darylise Lyons, Malcolm Burnley, and Sarah Gaither. We have much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Have you ever been asked this question, what are you? Well, that's what people who are biracial get asked all the time, asked either directly or indirectly. And today on The Connection, we're talking about some of the challenges, some of the benefits of having multiple racial identities, especially in a country that sees things either as Black or white. And again, Darylise Lyons and Malcolm Burnley co-hosted a podcast that you can listen to called On Being Biracial. Daryl Lees is publisher of the Chestnut Hill Mount Airy Locals, and Malcolm Burnley, staff writer for the Philadelphia Citizen. Also with us is Sarah Gaither. She's a professor of psychology and director of the Identity and Diversity Lab at Duke University. Sarah, I want to go back to you and just put one more thing that Donald Trump said, and then we will move on from him. But he talked about, there was some testimony that he gave about Indian casinos. And this was, I think this goes back to 1993. There was some argument about, casinos, I guess Indian casinos versus his casinos in Atlantic City. And one of the things he said was, well, they don't look Indian to me. And I wonder, Sarah, we talk about the visual. I mean, we do operate under certain assumptions. And I wonder, what kind of challenge that creates for people who are of multiple races.
Yeah, well, first, I think this isn't even an assumption. It's just an incorrect factual knowledge on Trump's part, right? They're completely different cultural groups, heritage groups, everything about it as distinct as possible. But I think from a race angle, the way most people would define what race is, it is largely based on how you look or how you appear to others, right? Because that equates so much to how you're treated in society, right? People who have darker skin, this has been shown in a lot of work, you get longer sentences in criminal trials, right? So these phenotypic differences are really, really critical in defining what a lot of people think race is or what race can't be. And that's what, again, I think someone like Kamala Harris is shifting for us in a very public way right now, in that you don't just have to be white or black. You could be South Asian and black and have immigrant parents and all of these things. And that's still a completely valid, normal thing to be.
Well, and I think we're sort of stuck in this binary worldview. People are either this or that. And I wonder, I was even thinking of gender identity, how people are just more fluid and more open and more curious about their identities and willing to embrace multiple identities. And I wonder if you see some parallels here, Darlise.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think I talked about that when I did the TED Talk, was about, the parallels with gender. And I think, one of the arguments against any identity being more dynamic or more of a spectrum experience is always like, well, I don't understand that, or that makes me uncomfortable. And I think that's such a misunderstanding of why someone would identify. They're not trying to make other people comfortable. They're trying to honor their own unique experience and who they are and how they see themselves and how they've lived and who they love. And I mean that, when it comes to gender or sexuality, but also like in terms of race, for me, if I identify as one thing or another, it discounts, personally, the people that I've loved and lived with and grown up around. And so, yeah, I think there are a lot of parallels. And I think that the more that we as a society can think dynamically and create space for people and for their true selves and true gifts and, cultural experiences and lived experiences to emerge, I think we're really creating a richer society where people can bring their full selves forward and be more authentic and shine their light and own their gifts. So I think it really is incumbent upon all of us to create the space for people to be who they are.
Sarah, let me ask you, what is that discomfort about? Darlise was talking about, embracing multiple identities and that making other people uncomfortable. What is that discomfort? What's at the base of that?
We as humans, we love social categories. We learn through social categories. It's how we learn language, right? We hear different similar sounds over time and we group them together, just like we end up grouping people based on physical features for race and ethnicity and otherwise. So we live in a complicated social world and we have to use shortcuts sometimes to help us deambiguate what it is we're seeing and experiencing. And so I sort of view this multiracial discussion and the expanding demographic and the acknowledgement doing in the U.S. society in particular right now is shifting what it can mean to be a member of any of these racial groups and reminding us that we can be more than one thing, right? And regardless of if anyone listening is not multiracial, right, everyone has multiple identities, right? You're a professor, a daughter, a mother, whatever it is. So this isn't a new concept, and yet having multiple identities within the same social space, such as race or ethnicity, is what I think is difficult for people to comprehend. It's hard for us to think about, oh, well, you have multiple influences in how it is you talk or the foods that you like. So I think we're getting closer to accepting that, which I think is what made Kamala Harris's speech last night so incredible when she said, on behalf of everyone whose story could only be written in the greatest nation on earth. I think she was alluding in an indirect way, right, that we are multifaceted, right? Anyone whose story is here means anything is possible.
Indeed. Malcolm, go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to inject one other thing into the conversation about, you know, race, even though it is a construction, right, particularly in America, it's been we've organized
social construction.
Yeah, social construction, I should say. Yeah, we've organized so many things around it. And so there is also a, I guess, pragmatic fear, I think, for a lot of people. Just to give an example, you know, now that the census allows you to check two or more races, right, we always talk about the black vote, right? Or, you know, allocating money to a certain population based on race. So if you start checking two, right, how does that work? Are you double counting the vote? If I'm identifying as two or more races but not checking black, you know, is that going to pull resources away? So there is also, I guess, a fear. You know, I wrote a piece for the Philadelphia Citizen called Fear of a Biracial President, which only touched on this. But, you know, it is disrupting not just how people think about individual people, but disrupting systems and ways of organizing that it's just going to be interesting to see how it plays out. I think we really do have to retrain our minds and also our systems to understand the implications. And then I think what it really does is it retrains us to understand what race really is and what it isn't.
Yeah. And I wanted to, Terralisa, and all three of you really, by embracing, you know, all your racial identities, put it plural that way, whether that allows you, well, I assume it allows you to see the world in a different kind of way.
Yeah, I would say that that it does, embracing all of my identities. But for me, identity is largely experiential. And so when I talk about my identities, what I'm talking about is these experiences that have been opened to me on the basis of the fact that I hold many things inside of myself. And so, I've had access to lots of different places and cultural influences. And I think there are echoes of that in the speech that Kamala Harris gave last night, right? Where she was talking about her dad who said, you know, run, Kamala, run, and her mother who sort of infused and breathed life into certain concepts for her. And so I think that I could identify differently and yet still have had the same exposure and experiences that I have had. And there are many people in this country that do, that identify differently than me, but hold all of these different cultural influences. And so I guess the question that you asked was more about like access and multiplicity and seeing things in a different way. And but I think that a lot of people who have exposure to different cultures, different races, different religions, different, you know, backgrounds, see things in a different way by virtue of the fact that their vision has been expanded. But I don't want to conflate that with the fact that I identify in a more expanded way, because I think, right, you can identify in a way that is monoracial and still have access, which is why, you know, diversity is so important for young people, mm-hmm, right? Exposure to different things is so important, because that's what opens up our viewpoints. And there's a children's book author and illustrator and educator, Rudine Bishop, who talks about mirrors, windows, and sliding glass doors. I won't bore everyone with that explanation here, but I will say that I think that's one of the values of my particular experience as someone who is multiracial, is that I've had windows to different identity experiences, a whole lot of mirroring, and a whole lot of sliding glass doors throughout my life. And I think that makes me a more dynamic thinker in general, having nothing to do with race.
And Sarah, just picking up on what Malcolm and Darylise are saying up here in Philadelphia in our studios here, if we become a more multiracial society beyond the 10% of people who say they are multiracial, will that help us address the problem of racism and discrimination? Is there a connection there?
Yes. I mean, people ask me all the time, is racism going to go away when all the multiracial people take over, right? And to be clear, I think we're a very long, long away, away from racism leaving this planet. But what I do think we're seeing is, because of these, you know, more nuanced discussions about race, you know, what my work and other people's work has shown is that for multiracial people, this experience of code switching or perspective taking, this actually can make you a better problem solver. You can navigate more diverse contexts more easily, right? We saw this with former President Barack Obama. There were tons of articles about him code switching into black speech versus white speech, and how that was such an incredible advantage in him being able to kind of merge these communities. And being this, you know, I don't like this term, a bridge, right? I don't like that multiracial people are sort of seen in that way. but it's giving us this new way of thinking about race and discussing race. And what we also are seeing is that by thinking about what race can be outside of these fixed boxes, anyone, even if you're not multiracial, if I ask you to think of your multiple identities, we've actually shown in our own work that that boosts your problem solving abilities too. Right. So this isn't to say that multiracial people are superheroes, even though I think we are, obviously. But we all have this capacity to think flexibly, and a lot of it is based on the diversity, contact, and exposure that we choose to have or choose not to have.
And flexibility being the sort of the word, the important word there, Sarah?
Yeah, flexible thinking. So you think more flexibly at what a social category is or isn't. Even coming up with problems on a multiple choice exam comes easier. There was really cool work that for college students who come back from studying abroad, again, even if you're not multiracial, that forced kind of cross-cultural experience, you come back temporarily a better problem solver too.
Interesting. You know, I was looking at it was a Time magazine cover, I think from 1993, which was based, and I think the headline was something like The New Face of America. And it was a computer-generated image, and they had sort of loaded in, I guess, certain racial characteristics and came up with this very generic-y looking woman, I believe woman's face.
Yeah.
But the message was, well, we're going to move into this sort of raceless society. Malcolm, is that something you yearn for?
You know, no. Yeah, I don't think it's realistic. And I think, you know, it's been interesting to see Kamala Harris's candidacy and bringing us back or bringing me back to conversations when Barack Obama was first running. And there was a lot more that I think that that rhetoric around a post-racial America. And, you know, I think if you want to call it optimism or just, you know, the hope around that, you know, I think we saw with his presidency, it was almost the opposite. You know, it was the less he talked about it, the more people made everything about race and about him being black. And, you know, Obamacare was anti-white. And I just used the term Obamacare. And I feel like that in itself was kind of, you know, infused with a lot of connotations. But no, I don't think, you know, we're getting there. And I don't necessarily think we should aspire to. But certainly to Sarah's points, you know, I really appreciated Sarah's point about allowing other people to understand that they contain a multiplicity of identities.
Absolutely.
And that they, whether you want to use the term code switching or not, you know, everyone shows up differently in different spaces. And I think that will help people empathize with, you know, the multiracial experience.
I mean, that's, I think, how whether we're aware of it or not, it's how we navigate the world. The way we operate in a taxi is going to be different from a board meeting.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. Yeah.
When you see that image, that Time magazine, I mean, it's, you know, it's eons ago, 1993, I mean, it is this sort of very bland, generic-y looking face.
It is. Well, and it sort of reminds me of, you know, there's I don't hear this so much anymore, but there was a time in our society when people said, like, oh, I don't see color. You know, I don't see color, as if that was a virtue. But I think, you know, even though race is a social construct, I think that there is beauty to any racial experience. There's beauty to the ethnic experiences that we hold, to the cultures that, you know, that people celebrate. And I mean, people of all racial backgrounds and identities have rich cultural heritages. And so I think that, to me, it would be unfortunate to live in a society in which race is, you know,
erased
or culture is erased. I don't think that homogeny should be the goal. I think that it should be, you know, really embracing and celebrating and allowing space for no one culture, no one race to be a non-hierarchical relationship with race and identity, wherein we can really learn from one another and also know our limitations. I mean, there's certain cultures that I have no experience of or access to, and that's perfectly okay. I mean, to bring it back to what Trump said about indigenous people, like, who cares if they, you know, if he sees, if they look, you know, a certain way to him, because it's not his experience, it's not his community. And I think part of it for me is about, like, allowing people to embrace all of who they are, and also knowing my limits as a person, that, like, I'm not going to understand everything, and I don't have to.
Right. You don't know everything. Sarah, we're almost out of time here, but do you see sort of, because we've been talking about a lot of things, identity, belonging, race, history, all of that. I mean, do you see this country making progress on this front?
I mean, yeah, I saw progress when Barack Obama was elected, right? We called him our first Black president. I strongly called him my first biracial president, right, at my own in-group membership. So I think we're making progress, but it doesn't mean to say issues with race and the systemic issues, especially regarding race, right, are going away. And I think that's what this current campaign season is reminding us, that we're not in a post-racial society. Race is very real. It has real outcomes and real consequences. And a lot of that is based on how we think someone looks or how we think they should look. And what those associations and stereotypes are.
I want to squeeze in one more quick question to you, Sarah. I'm wondering, for people who are biracial who claim one race over the other, I wonder how that affects the parent of, the, you know, whose race they did not choose.
Yeah, that's a complicated question. There's not a lot of actual data on that. The other question I get asked quite often is, if you're a mixed race person being raised in a single parent family, mm-hmm. right, you're only exposed to one of your cultures over the others. It can be disheartening for that one parent whose culture is sort of denied. And what we see sometimes is the parents of the culture that's being denied will end up kind of reacting either by claiming the other identity in that family structure, or trying to remind their child, right, in subtle ways about what their heritage on the other side may mean. So we find other difficulties when you look at the parents of the growing demographic, too.
Well, it's complicated, as we have been saying. My thanks to all three of you for joining us today on The Connection. Sarah Gaither, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. And she is a professor of psychology, director of the Identity and Diversity Lab at Duke University. Malcolm Burnley, thank you for joining us on The Connection.
Good to see you, Marty. Thanks.
Good to see you as well. Staff writer for the Philadelphia Citizen, co-host of the On Being Biracial podcast. Darylise Lyons, thank you for joining us on The Connection.
Thank you, Marty, and thanks to everyone who's listening.
Absolutely. And she's the other host of the On Being Biracial podcast, and she's also publisher of the Chestnut Hill and Mount Airy Locals. Thank you for joining us on The Connection, which airs every Friday and Sunday at noon right here on WHYY. You can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts, and you can listen to us on the WHYY app. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of the show, produced by Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us.